Well, Russell Targ has touched on something. It's called the end of suffering. It's something that I think you need to hear, especially nowadays. So we'll talk with him about it in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our special guest, Russell Targ. Russell, the movement toward your book, The End of Suffering, Fearless Living in Troubled Times, and I love this, or How to Get Out of Hell for Free. You know what? It's about time. Tell me how you decided to write this book.
Well, it started sitting in the dark room at Stanford Research Institute, where I had this decade of experience discovering that who I am could not possibly be just a physical body because my awareness filled all of space-time. It was crystal clear that I was able to describe and experience things and events, people in the distance and in the future, so I couldn't possibly be just a body because my awareness was all over the universe that had nothing to do with my body. So it'd be silly to think that I was just the meat and potatoes sitting in my chair. So I began to have spiritual feelings and investigations. And in the course of that, I left Lockheed because I felt that that was not the place for me. And returned to my roots and doing laser research. I went to Lockheed, which is probably not a big improvement over SRI. But I was doing laser work rather than a part of a top secret program. I wasn't working with the CIA anymore. And the first thing I discovered at Lockheed with my laser activity, in reading the Lockheed newspaper that's published every week, I would notice that they had an in memoriam section and people would be retiring from Lockheed and then die within a couple of years. And that's very disturbing, of course, for a new employee. Where I saw that people would retire at 65 and die at 67 or die at 68. So being a good statistician, I got 100 of the past newspapers and quickly calculated that the observed life expectancy of a retiring engineer was 3 more years, whereas you would expect a guy who would live to be 65, he would live to be 80 or 82.
Sure.
Because a 65-year-old had passed all the hazards. He wasn't going to get killed in the war. He wasn't going to be shot in the face by his hunting partner. He avoided all the hazards. So my question is, why are people dying so rapidly? And in talking to psychologists, what I realized is that people died because they lost the idea of their own self. When you got to be 65 at Lockheed, you were very proud that you were a Lockheed engineer. That's what it said on your business card.
Right.
And at least in Silicon Valley, being a Lockheed engineer was a prestigious member of the community. You'd been there for many, many years. And then the government takes away your badge. Lockheed tears up your business card, sends you home with nothing to do but annoy your wife. And suddenly, instead of being a staff scientist at Lockheed, you're nothing. They've taken away the story of who you are. And this was early death occurred at Lockheed and at Boeing and Bell Telephone Laboratory, and also for Army officers. And it's really the loss of a person's ego. We invest a lot of energy in defending the story of who we think we are. And when you lose that story, you suddenly become nothing. If you think that who you are is that story, it's as though another source of a lot of suffering is the idea that if you think that what you see in the mirror in the morning is who you are, you all know that that leads to a lot of suffering. You don't want to be simply what you see in the mirror in the morning. And the teaching is what remote viewing leads you to discover is you couldn't possibly be just that face you see in the mirror, but really you're a spirit, you're an awareness that fills all of space-time. So on the one hand, you have all these engineers who are dying very prematurely when their business card, when their story gets snipped off, And the other people we know who have trouble are the movie stars and record and famous singers, rock stars like Marilyn Monroe and Elvis Presley, the King, and Janis Joplin and Jim Morrison, and our favorite Jimi Hendrix. All these people, the musicians in that group, Jimi Hendrix and Jim Morrison, the Doors, had all platinum or double platinum records being produced when they killed themselves. Marilyn Monroe had just gotten a new contract with Fox when she did herself in. And all these people were very depressed and wound up killing themselves with alcohol and sleeping pills. Just a tried and true way of putting yourself to sleep permanently, because it's as though their self had been stolen from them by their fans. It's a kind of Dionysian murder where their ego, their identity, was just ripped out of their body, and these rock stars began to believe that who they were was what appeared on the cover of the album or what you saw on the screen.
So true, Russell. And they let it happen to themselves.
Well, it's very seductive. The phone is ringing, and you got this pink Cadillac, and people are telling you you're wonderful. And you begin to think that you begin to identify in a disastrous way with your story. Arthur Miller, the great playwright, was Marilyn Monroe's husband. And in his biography of his wife, Marilyn Monroe, he says what was lethal is the fact that there became no separation between his wife, Marilyn, and the girl that was her great comedic creation, the girl on the screen. The whispering, lisping Marilyn became inseparable from his wife, and then she died. So one of the clues to end your suffering is to get away from the idea that who you are is this story of your life. I recently saw a program about prisoners, and a young man was explaining that, yes, he did shoot the guy who just walked by him on the street. And he said, well, he disrespected me. I had to kill him. And that's why the SUVs are pushing me off the road on my little motorbike, because there's a kind of aggression that we see in the streets with crowding and fearfulness, that everybody is asserting their ego and asserting who they think they are because they're defending the story. And part of that's because of the times we live in. You can't blame it all on George Bush, but he's certainly part of the problem, because he says to us things like, you're either with me or you're with the terrorists. And of course, many people think that there are other decisions. And the Buddhists say that when we have causes that come from many sources, dependent co-arising. So if you want to know, no one is saying, why were the Twin Towers knocked down on 9/11? You have a lot of conversation about who did it. And there's many people are talking about who did it. But there's very little conversation about why it was done.
You're so right, Russell, because if we began to answer that question of why they committed this horrible deed, and they need to be punished, and I hope a lot of people understand that.
A Buddhist would say, if you want to know why the Twin Towers were blown up, you would start with the Crusades. You can't start with the day before yesterday.
Yeah. I don't know if you have to go back that far, but what you're saying is absolutely true, and you're on the right track, and you have picked up on a feeling, a pulse that is happening on this planet right now, and it's got to be changed before it's too late.
Because we're in an area now where, with the idea that you're with us or you're with the terrorists, and the government keeps flipping back and forth the color-coded threat levels. I do a lot of traveling, so I'm very sensitive to suddenly show up at the airport and we have a red threat level and they take away my toothpaste. And there's a kind of politics of fear, what the psychologists call learned helplessness. And learned helplessness is when the fear level gets flipped from red to yellow, back to red, down to orange, and you don't know what the hell's going on, and whatever it is, and don't forget bird flu, which suddenly pops up and then disappears.
True. And we've said on this program, Russell, it's not going to be a pandemic. Not to worry, and already it's being faded away. Of course, there'll be another disease that they'll come up with probably next year.
But this idea that a thing is either true or it's not true, you're either a terrorist or not terrorist, that's something that Aristotle gave us. If you remember, Aristotle is the one who said happiness is when you're healthy, wealthy, famous, and beautiful, and that's just the wrong answer. Happiness is when you have an idea of who you are and you can experience your own flow of loving awareness. So if you're not feeling happy and peaceful, don't blame George Bush. You got to start with Aristotle.
Well, and you also have to blame yourself, because so many people have mired themselves in the muck that they don't know how to pull out of it, Russell.
That's absolutely true. So it's the idea that as you can, well, one of the things that Buddhists talk about is enlightenment, they say, is the transcendent, joyful experience of not wanting anything. I shouldn't say this on your show, which is well-sponsored, but the purpose of advertising is to make you suffer, to make you want things you didn't know you needed. And we don't have to say any more about that. But happiness comes from not needing anything beyond what you have.
You know, the people who are truly unhappy, can they truly find themselves? Can they end their suffering?
Well, the people who are truly unhappy are in general, well, there are people who are suffering from existential problems, like they have intractable poverty, they're living in the streets, and for one reason or another, they're starving and homeless. There are also people who are suffering because they've lost a loved one. A child died, or a lover left them, or they're dying in a hospital, or they're in a concentration camp. But that's a very tiny, and I respect the suffering that those people have, that really comes at them from the outside. If somebody is just hit by a car and is in the hospital, you can't blame them for their suffering. But by and large, in prosperous America, people are warm and dry. If you look around in the supermarkets, everybody seems to have enough to eat. The suffering comes from inside, defending a story of who they think they are. They have a picture of how it ought to be.
Russell, you're absolutely right. Look at people. They have nice... I'm talking about generally now. There are some people who are truly destitute. But you have most people, they have a nice home. They may have a couple cars. You know, they buy the kind of clothes they want. Maybe their credit cards are maxed, and that could be another reason for their suffering. But by and large, people begin to look at material things as a quest for happiness, and it's not going to happen that way.
There's all the Buddhist teachings and most of the Hindu teachings basically invite you to sit down and be quiet and discover the flow of loving awareness that's within yourself. Many, many of the Buddhist teachers and the Hindu teachers taught silently, and the love that they were experiencing just became available to the person who was sitting with them, and you discover that love is who you are. And in our own society in the 80s, there's a Mark Almond album that I'm sure you know called Looking for Love in All the Wrong Places. That's the idea that I'm a pretty good half a person. If I could only find a pretty good half a partner, then the two of us together, she could fulfill all my lacks, and between us, we could make a pretty good whole person. That, of course, never works, because as soon as she quits doing for me whatever she did to make me feel like a whole person, the love I felt for her disappears and will often turn into hate. And what all the wisdom teachers say is that love is very desirable, love between two people who love one another is very desirable, but don't expect her to fix you. You've got to find out who you are, experience your own loving nature, which is who you are, and that flow of loving awareness is available to anyone who will sit down and be quiet and explore mindfulness.
You know, Russell, you were talking about the rock stars and you're using some of the analogies of how things went to their head and they got carried away. Yet there are some rock stars that stayed grounded, albeit they played around, they experimented with drugs, but they still seem to have stayed grounded. Those that are remained alive today, of the Beatles, for example, I think still are grounded. How did they seem to avoid this situation?
Well, the Beatles in general had wives and girlfriends, which is very desirable. They were not playing around with amphetamines, which causes a person to implode and go crazy. They're experimenting with LSD, which is a kind of entheogen, which takes you outside yourself and allows you to experience the divine or have some kind of transcendent experience. They also had a teacher. They went to India, and they were all learned to meditate and stop the chatter. They were also fiercely against the war, in favor of peace and opposed to the war. So their focus as anti-war activists was a focus on something outside of themselves. They had a mission. They were trying to reduce suffering. And that's really the meaning of life. That is, if you, from my perspective, and many of the wisdom teachers, what gives life meaning is to experience the divine, your own. And I'm not asking you to believe anything. That should be clear for what I've said. I'm talking about direct experience of your own loving nature, your own divine self, and then to share that experience. And the Beatles were doing that. The Beatles were profoundly interested in helping reduce suffering, and their focus was away from their own ego, away from their own selves. How can we be helpful? And they weren't using amphetamines or alcohol particularly, which causes people to crash and curl up in a ball.
Well, here's a perfect example for what you're saying, too. People who are road ragers are truly unhappy for the moment, and they need to get a grip of themselves, on themselves, in order to avoid those problems.
Yeah, I agree with that. As I mentioned, that's why I rode my motorcycle here for 35 years in the San Francisco Bay Area, and traffic has, even though the population is about the same, the traffic has become ridiculous. The combination of SUVs and people racing around at high speed and through traffic lights, it's as though people are just angry, frustrated. And the idea of learned helplessness is really very important. Well, when you take a mouse and capture him in a sock so he can't go anywhere, just lets his little nose poke out, that rat will get very depressed and die even though nothing's happened to him. And they call that learned helplessness. And our society is experiencing that as the news stations make us feel more and more helpless, and the threat levels are flipped from doomsday red to yellow to orange, and we have no control over it, and every day there's a new hazard. It makes it very hard for us to deal with it.
All right, stay with us, Russell. We're going to talk about some steps that you would recommend for people to get out of this hell for free. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And we're going to continue our discussion with Russell Targ in the next hour. It'll be your turn. We'll open up the phone lines. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. So how do people pull themselves out of this, Russell? What are some of the steps that you recommend?
I wanted to mention that on my computer, two people wrote to me about identical twins and the uncanny things that happened between them and their twin partner. One of the women says that her twin sister died, and she feels that she just lost an irreplaceable part of herself because of the uncanny connection that the two of them had. So I wanted to mention there's a very good book on telepathy with twins, and the book is called Twin Telepathy by an English writer, Guy Playfair. And people who are interested in twins would probably like that, especially the two people who wrote to me about the ESP between themselves and their twins.
Very good. Very good. Now, Ken, back to some of these steps, recommendations for people to pull themselves out of the hole that they find themselves in. What do they do?
Well, the first thing that you notice is that you have to get control of your mental activity. You have to find the off switch on your chattering mind. And the Buddhists call this mindfulness, the way of stopping your incessant, ongoing chatter. And meditation is, of course, the way to do that. And as I mentioned earlier, what you want to explore is, under mindfulness, is transcendent knowing, which is, first of all, discovering that you're not a physical body or you're not just a physical body. Now, I want to be clear that I'm not saying something silly. I have great respect for bodies. The Buddhists teach that bodies are hard to come by and we should take good care of them, a great source of pleasure, but it's simply an error to think that a physical body is all that you are. So with transcendent knowing, you begin to expand your awareness and discover that you can experience the distance and the future, and it realizes there's more to you than what you see in the mirror. With transcendent doing, you can begin to move outside yourself and use your awareness to heal the sick, send love to people in a distant place, and relieve the suffering from people in the distance. That would be transcendent doing. And transcendent being is an opportunity to move from your ego self to spaciousness. That we tend to live in what the Buddhists call an ego-centered, self-pitying world, sort of conditioned awareness. We're conditioned by what your parents taught you and what your president teaches you, and that conditioning can't help but lead to suffering because you become self-centered and self-pitying, sort of determined by your own ego, filled with resentment and judgment, and that also interferes with your psychic abilities, because once you feel that you want to name and grasp what you're experiencing, you can't really experience it for it is. So the invitation is to move from an ego-based conditioned awareness to transcendent awareness, which is a feeling of spaciousness, what the Buddhists call naked existence. So the move is really very simple. You move from an ego-based awareness where you're mm-hmm. focusing on your own self-centered problems. My minister used to call it sitting on your pity pot. You want to get off your pity pot and move into spaciousness. And once you begin, now, I'm not saying that remote viewing is a spiritual path. I try and avoid saying the things that are silly. Once you start doing remote viewing, you get the clue that there's a lot more going on than you read in the newspapers. You get a feeling that the spaciousness is available, and we often don't know why the great mystics and the saints would be sitting on a rock, but nobody ever felt that they were silly. And the reason they did that is that that feeling of spaciousness leads to a generous, flexible, loving, and joyful experience. Once you find a way to separate yourself from defending your ego and moving into the spaciousness, in the English underground, there's a sign that says, beware the gap, or mind the gap. And it's really the gap between the ego-based life that we tend to live, defending the story of who we are. And from my many years in aerospace, I can tell you that defending the story of who you are is definitely the road to suffering. And moving from that ego-based condition to spaciousness is just a flip of the switch. You just find a way to stop the chatter, which is usually some kind of quiet breathing meditation, and you move from the ego base to the spaciousness, and you're free.
But it doesn't mean, Russell, that you shouldn't try or strive to be successful or happy with the right job or anything like that, does it?
Well, that takes us to the next principle. The first principle is mindfulness, and you said exactly the right thing. In my opinion, I'm not a Buddhist scholar. I'm just a physicist trying to learn how to be peaceful. But the most important thing that goes through all the Buddhist teaching is the idea of emptiness. And people hate that idea. They say, as I look out here, it looks to me like something's happening. Well, what do you mean emptiness? And the teaching is that nothing is happening except to the extent that you give it meaning. That we have an opportunity to give meaning to everything that occurs. There's a Buddhist newspaper in California called the DOT, the D-O-T, and their masthead says, nothing is happening and we print every word. And the idea is that the only extent to which anything at all is happening is the extent to we give it meaning. For example, since I just gave up driving, I'm full of driving stories. If you're driving, if you're driving down the highway, down the freeway, and somebody cuts you off, you can make a rude hand signal to him or swear at him or do all kinds of things or tell your passenger, he just cut me off, and be very angry about it. And people do that all the time and do crazy things. But that's really not a correct picture of what's happening. And this is important because it pertains to much of what goes on in our lives. Driving in the freeway or driving in traffic is essentially random motions, like Brownian motion. Cars are moving in and out, and they really don't have any attention on you at all. They didn't cut you off. They just move to the left and move to the right. And the extent to which you personalize this random flow that's occurring, the flow is occurring, but it doesn't have any meaning. You give it meaning. You say, that bastard cut me off, and that's not really correct. You had nothing to do with his motion. He just moved. And the extent to which you personalize the crazy things that happen in the world is the extent to which you increase your own suffering. For example, if you're running along the beach, as we like to do in California, and you're knocked over by a wave, now nobody's going to give the finger to the wave. Say that damn wave, look at what he did to me. That'd be silly. No one would do that because you realize the wave is a random occurrence.
And it was probably your fault for being too close.
That's right. But much of the things that happen to us in our life happen and have no meaning except for the meaning that we attach to it, or we misassess the meaning. So when the Buddhists talk about emptiness, they want you to move away from this ego-centered, self-pitying loneliness, because most of what happened is empty of meaning. That is, having a good job and living in a house where the roof doesn't leak is a good idea. There's nothing the matter with that, but just don't get attached to it, because there is no permanence. There's everything. That is, the Four Noble Truths end with the truth that nothing is permanent, and people are very worried about the idea of impermanence.
It's social. You have to be happy first within yourself.
That's right. You can't be angry at impermanence any more than you're angry at gravity.
What about your family that you might care about and love, Russell? If you see a family member trapped in this situation here that you write in the book, The End of Suffering, is it our duty, our responsibility to try to pull them out of it, or can they only do it for themselves?
Well, if you've ever tried to help a family member who's suffering, you know that it's impossible. But what you can do is point them in the right direction. You can give them tools. And when they hit bottom, when they've had enough, then they can change what they're doing. certainly what gives meaning to our lives is to experience our own divine nature and then to help other people have that experience. And it's easier to do that with somebody who is not deeply into suffering. But certainly compassion and recognizing that there are many bodies but one consciousness, which is one of the things that we notice. If we live in a world filled with telepathy and mind-to-mind connection, it seems clear that the separation between individuals is much less of a separation than we think. The Buddha keeps telling us that separation is an illusion, just as the modern physicists tell us that entanglement is part of our life and there is no separation. So finally, the modern physicists have caught up with the Buddhists of 2,500 years ago.
Now,
with regard to helping family members,
yes,
I think that's very desirable. And you can help somebody to the extent that they want to be helped.
You know, in this society, how there are givers and takers, Russell. Are the takers unhappy people?
Anybody who has feelings of attachment is a sign of an unhappy person. The Buddhist teaching, I once went to a lecture where there are a whole collection of Buddhist teachers, one after the other, and the last fellow was an elderly Chinese Lama, and he said, I know you're all tired. You can't really understand me that well anyway. Let me just leave you with two words, and it's a path of happiness. And his two words were empty, empty, happy, happy. And I told a friend of mine that, who's a very successful Silicon Valley programmer, and he said, empty, empty, happy, happy. I can understand that. What's wrong with full, full, happy, happy, to the sort of Silicon Valley program? And I said, there's nothing wrong with it except it's been tried for 2,000 years and found to not work. That if your focus is on getting more stuff and acquiring more things and that kind of attachment, it's one of these things like seems like a good idea but never works.
Could that be the same thing for corporations that try to gobble up other companies, countries that try to gobble up other countries?
It certainly is. The more attached you are and judgmental, there's a whole continuum that goes from attachment, fear, and judgment. I mean, in Silicon Valley, where I live, I used to be in aerospace, a big company, where a day without judgment was like a day without sunshine. Everyone is busily trying to determine how much smarter or more successful they are than their neighbor.
How much money they can make, everything else.
And this attachment to stuff and to prestige, and it always comes, in my opinion, it always comes back to ego. It always comes back to the story of who you are. If you weren't defending the story, then you wouldn't have a giant Hummer. I mean, why does our governor have to drive a giant Hummer and try and be a green governor? It's a crazy situation, and it's because he's a strongest man in the world. He's a Terminator. He's got to drive a Hummer. It's just a sign of the crazy world we live in.
Well, I tell you, Russell, you've got a brilliant mind. And how then do you combine modern-day science with the psychic world? Is there a mesh there?
There's absolutely a mesh. We live in this golden age where people have finally agreed with Schrodinger from the 1920s that we live in a non-local world, that we live in a world that is, the economists would tell you and the physicists have proven it, that we live in a non-local, interdependent, interconnected world. David Bohm said that we live in a world of quantum interconnectedness. And this non-local world we live in allows us to have remote viewing into the distance, into the future, and experience our own loving nature as part of who we are. So really the important idea is that you don't have to look. I'm in favor of romance, and I'm in favor of having a loving partner. I have a loving partner, and I'm very happy for that. But in order to do that, you have to find your, you have to first find your own loving nature. You have to discover who you are before you're fit to be in a relationship with another person.
And it's, oh, that's so true.
And it's discovering what the Buddhists have a, they talk of Vajra heart essence, that is the diamond essence of your own heart energy, which is really, in English, this flow of loving awareness that's avail. It's the reward for having a quiet mind. You suddenly get filled with love, this oceanic connection with all of nature, and a powerful transmitting teacher is a good step that can push you in that direction. But you can begin to get a glimmer of that by yourself, by meditating and discovering your own quiet nature, your own loving nature.
Why is it, Russell, that other countries, some other regions, seem to be more at peace with themselves than we are here as individuals?
Well, we're extremely acquisitive. America is an absurdly consumer-oriented society. We scare people. We scare other countries where they feel that we're both the most powerful and the most stupid at the same time, and of course that's very dangerous. There's half the people in our country, I was just reading Sam Harris's book, and on the basis of American religion, he says that half the people in the country feel that the world was created 6,000 years ago, and that's an American idea, and that scares the hell out of the rest of the world. That a country that has thousands of atomic bombs feel that the world began 6,000 years ago. People view us as very frightening.
Well, there's no question in my mind that a country that could become the most powerful has got to be brilliant on one hand, but at the same time, if you lose that and it whittles away, that also shows you just how foolish one could be.
Yeah, you have a third of the children in America have no health insurance, where every other industrialized country in the world has national health insurance. Only America, America's the only country without national health insurance.
And we pay pharmaceutical prices that are out of sight.
That's right. So we somehow lost the thread, because compassion is the key. That is, compassion is the last element that I didn't get to. The idea of experiencing your own divine nature. And what gives motivation to your life is to be helpful to other people.
And the compassion may very well be the most important of all these various steps that you've given us tonight, Russell.
I believe that. Recognizing that the poor, tired girl at the checkout counter is just a reflection of yourself and, in fact, is your own self. And when you look at her and realize that it's not that you could be that, but you are that, then you share that compassion and totally change the interaction.
I learned a long time ago, all you simply have to do is treat people the way you want to be treated, and a lot of these ills go away, Russell.
I spell this all out at the end of suffering, and I invite people to write to me on the internet at www.espresearch.com, and I'll answer your letters.
Want to take some phone calls next?
I'm happy to do that.
Let's do it. Next hour, it's your turn, Russell Targ. You'll never have an opportunity like this. Take advantage of it.